The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we've got the author of Cemetery Road, Greg Iles' brand new book, a number one New York Times best-selling author. I believe this, Greg, is about number 16. Is that correct?
It's 16 or 17. I've been confused myself. Mark, it's hard to believe, but I have been on the road. So let's just say it's around there.
All right. We will say that. And, you know, from what I understand, the very first book you had was a bestseller, and you haven't fallen off that list since.
Well, you know what's funny is the best book I ever wrote was my second book, and it's the only one out of all of them that wasn't a New York Times bestseller. And I think it's largely because the paperback jacket. But it's funny to me. It's sort of like with John Grisham when he had A Time to Kill and initially nobody read it. And then that may be his best book, you know?
This could be the world's shortest interview because all somebody has to do is read the very first chapter of Cemetery Road and they're hooked. I mean, this first chapter, and it's not long. I was going to count the words, but I couldn't count that high. What, maybe about 150, 250 or so?
Yeah, it's three paragraphs, and the third paragraph is only one sentence. I was on Mitch Albom's radio show the other day. Mitch plays in an all-author band with me, and Mitch actually was remarking on that passage and read it out loud. And he asked, you know, how hard you work on opening passages like that. You know, did I think they were important? And I don't work on them right at the start really hard, but I come back because I know it is critical to hook the reader.
Oh, yeah, and you did a great job on that. As you get into the book, you just want more.
Well, I hope so. That's my job, right?
Yeah. Now, you know, we have an archaeologist, and he has found something along the back banks of the Mississippi River. There are people that aren't very happy with that because this town could be in a loss of millions of dollars.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of the river towns in Mississippi and probably further north, certainly when you get up to the steel towns up this way, people in small towns been hurting for a long time. They lived in towns that were thriving and vibrant in the 60s and early 70s, and now they've sort of hit a tipping point. So
when a character threatens the salvation of a small town like that, it was an interesting thing to me because I know that the people in those towns are desperate, and I've wondered how far they would go to change their lives for the better. Let me say I'm a little misleading. It's a little authorial misdirection, the way this book begins, because it begins with a sort of classic murder and what seems like a mystery, and I think for about 100 pages, people feel that's what it is. And then with the second murder, I pull the rug out from under, and you start to realize this is a much more personal story about two men from the same hometown who love the same woman and who have a very complicated friendship that goes through school, through war. It's a bigger scale than you perceive at first.
How difficult is that for you to write something like that? You're off in one direction and then you turn. And I think of, and I can't remember the director who wrote Carrie and Body Double and some of those other movies, but all of a sudden you think you know what you've got.
Yeah, it's Brian De Palma, right? Brian De Palma.
Oh man, he's a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be able to change it like that, and you doing that to Cemetery Road, I mean, how difficult is that?
I think it would be difficult if you didn't have a good idea. I mean, if you didn't know the secret at the heart of the mystery, you couldn't successfully do it. A lot of people have asked me out this time, do you know the end when you start? You know, how much do you know? How locked in are you? I don't like to lock myself in on the journey to the end, but you have to know the end if you've ever seen that great movie called The Prestige with Michael Caine and Christian Bale about magic, it's just, yeah, this is The Prestige, you know, to take people to the end and reveal the twist, you got to know the beginning. And so to pull the rug out, you got to know that too.
Not only that, but you've got twists and turns in there, and you're looking at different stories throughout the book also. And that's got to be a sign of a great author.
I don't know, but I'll tell you what, writing that trilogy took me 10 years and over 2,400 pages. And, you know, I had to interweave real civil rights murders with fiction, real history with fictional history. And that was pretty good training for the kind of thing we're talking about. So I don't know how great I am, but I've certainly been trained for it at this point.
You know, Greg, last time I talked to you was on that trilogy, and those books were coming out, I believe, if I remember right, about once every 2 years or so. These books here, now I know that some of the characters have been in other books also that you've written, a book like Cemetery Road. How long does this take? And it's a pretty massive book.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. People who don't know me and haven't read it, I'll be talking to a TV anchor and they'll say, you know, this is a big book. And I laugh and say, you know, actually, this is a short one for me. It's only 600 pages. But how long it takes, really, that's a tough question because for me, you know this, for me, the writing isn't the tough part. It's the evolution of the story in the writer's mind, psyche, emotions. That's where the work happens. The writing for me is sort of the drudgery at the end that I do at a frantic pace. I mean, I'd say I spent about 5-6 months working a minimum of 12 hours a day, sometimes 24 and 30 hours at a time to do this.
With a book like this, this takes place in Mississippi. You live in Mississippi. Is this a fictional town, a real town? Is this maybe a place that you've been?
It's a fictional town, Mark, but I'll tell you, I'm worried because the trilogy, really my other books too, but the trilogy created almost a stream of tourists on its own. I mean, there's a Greg Isles tour that lasts 3 hours, and people come from New Zealand and Europe and everywhere, and they go look at all the sites in these books. And I'm worried tourists are going to be driving up and down Highway 61 looking for Bienville, and it's not there. I don't know what I'm going to do about that, you know?
The last books that you wrote, the trilogy that you wrote, real places and everything, a place like this, fictional, do you have something where you are keeping track of where everything is, or is this just devoted to your memory?
No, you're right. That's a good question. Nobody's really asked me that yet. You know what you do? I was a musician before I was a writer, and I was a little bit of an artist before that. And so somewhere along the time, I really began to put words down into the processor, into the computer. I realized the memory wasn't going to be enough, that you really have to have a structure. So I sat down with some graph paper, and I won't say all the tools I use, but I pulled together a real town. I pulled together a city map and the county and the acreage, and it's wedged in between Natchez and Vicksburg, Mississippi, two great historic cities. And in the history that I wove of this thing, really, I used a lot of factual information. I hope that some historians will not even be certain whether this is or is not a real place, that it's that real.
Well, your protagonist here, a journalist, Marshall, tell me a little bit about him.
Marshall is a guy that, to me, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so to me, guys like Woodward and Bernstein were real heroes. I never was a journalist. It's a great protagonist because, you know, I'm known as a crime novelist or thriller writer, but I've never used conventional heroes like cops and spies and U.S. marshals and detectives. You know, I use writers and lawyers and mayors and journalists, and I like real people who aren't trained to deal with the extraordinary because I think we relate so much better to that. So Marshall's a guy who left home at 18. His father blames him for something, a tragedy in the family, swore he'd never come back. He goes off to University of Virginia, where my son happens to be. There's a little trick of research right there. Anyway, he does really well, and then he has to drop everything when he's 45 years old to come back and take care of his father. So he's sort of an investigative journalist in the vein of Woodward and Bernstein, but he's also a bit of a John Meacham character. He's made a lot of money. He's a pundit on television from time to time, and he's gotten a little comfortable. And when he comes back home to Mississippi, he finds more corruption than he even left in Washington.
So he's back to take care of his father. Now, do you still have your parents?
I lost my father. I lost my father. And I'll tell you, the hardest thing about this book is that, you know, my father was really Tom Cage from the trilogy, you know, and as with Penn and Tom, my dad and I, for the most part, had a great relationship. And the hardest thing about this book was writing a character who had a terrible or no relationship with his father. Now, I got to meet Pat Conroy not too long before he died. And, you know, if you look at a novelist like Conroy, he spent most of his life writing about a terrible and troubled relationship with his father. And it was really a leap for me. I mean, I've written two books, first person female, and I will say it was harder for me to write a male character who didn't get along with his father than anything I've ever done.
So what kind of lessons did you learn from your father that you put in maybe Cemetery Road, if anything?
A lot. You know, I put a lot of them in the trilogy, but I put some here. You know, Marshall's father is a guy who is a little bit related to guy figures like Hodding Carter. Think of papers like the Delta Democrat Times in Mississippi. There's some notable editors and writers who, during the civil rights era, really stood up and tried to do the right thing, at least by their lights at the time. And he's a guy who had a sort of a period of glory where he did that, and then he was an alcoholic for 40, 50 years after. And my dad had a little of that. But in general, guys like that from that generation, guys who live by code and who were harsh on themselves, as harsh on themselves as they were on others, those are sort of archetypal male figures. You don't even see them too much now. I don't know guys in my generation like that very much. They're people we try to live up to, and they have hard-earned wisdom, you know? And so I think Marshall's dad, while he's done some unfair things and unpleasant things, at his core, he's kind of that early 20th century American male that I was raised to revere and respect, you know?
Cemetery Road, your brand new book. Give me a little bit of a taste of that without giving too much away. I can say who was murdered. You know, I know this. I don't know if you want to give anything like that away. I don't know how far you want to go into it.
Let me say this for people. I know readers, we have a lot to choose from, and we're all looking for that book that just we get completely immersed in and we don't ever want it to end. And I think Cemetery Road is like that because at its core, look, there's a lot of realism there about the plight of the town and the poker club, you know, the powerful small group of men who control the town. That's very much based upon a lot of southern towns. But at its core, it's about the journalist who comes home and the girl he's loved since he was 14 years old was there. She's married to his best friend. That may sound corny, but you find that exists in real life quite a bit. And I also like that Marshall and his best friend Paul found themselves in a combat situation. Marshall is a journalist, Paul is a soldier, and one saved the other's life there. So when they get into a situation where they still love the same woman and one is betraying the other, the moral ground gets very soft and muddy beneath their feet, but that's how human life is. It's messy. I think people can relate to that. I think we look around the people we know. You look at that marriage you think is perfect, and that's the one you hear suddenly. Everyone's stunned. You hear they're getting divorced, you know. This story looks into those kind of issues, and I think we're all looking for insight into that.
With your characters, a lot of times authors will carry their characters in their head, whether it's at the supermarket, whether it's at theater or any place, they may carry that character. Did you do that with any of your characters? Did those characters become you?
Remember this, all your characters are with you all the time because all your characters are you. You know, some writers don't like to admit that, but I say all writers are writing about themselves, and if they tell you they're not, they're either lying or they don't know they're lying and they're really messed up. No, that's not to say that they're not, people, writers aren't using things they learn in their life or people they've met inspire characters, but if you're in a real novel that moves people and deals with real issues, every character has a piece of the author in there. So to say, you know, not in the sense of like an actor being in character, you know, like going through his daily life pretending to be somebody. But we're all writers are carrying all those characters with us. And you look at things through the different lenses of those characters. And as you approach the writing, you really start to feel that. So, yeah, that's a good question.
We were talking a little earlier and you said, you know, the tour is almost like the time when you were with your rock band, the Rock Bottom Remainders, going from town to town and sometimes not even knowing where you're going with a band, I guess, on tour with a book. I mean, it's a little different because I think they're spread out a little more. Are you still with the group, the Rock Bottom Remainders?
Yeah, absolutely. We're playing a show in Minneapolis in May. 4 weeks ago, I was down at Stephen King's house in Florida, woodshedding, playing old rock songs, and having the time of my life. Like, those are the best times in this business. But when I talk about the early days, I was in a band called Frankly Scarlet in the South, and that's where you really, you play till 2, you load equipment till 3 or 4, you drive to the next town, you sleep 3 hours, and go on stage again. I'm doing 2 or 3 cities a day on this book tour. And ironically, I brought my guitar with me. I was in Jackson, Mississippi. I brought it to play a Steve Earle protest song. And because I had it on my lap, I started to answer questions about writing by pointing out some things about song lyrics. And it was so popular, it went over so well, that I just decided to bring it with me. And I've been doing that to different degrees at different stops. And it's a great break from just a normal talking head kind of book signing. It's much more intimate, and people are just like a little party, you know?
I don't know if all the members are still with your group, and you might have to help me out here with the pronunciation, but Matt Groening.
Yeah, Matt Groening, I believe, with the Simpsons. Matt plays with us when we get, if we're close to California, Matt can find a way to get there. When we're in the East or anything, he's not with us. But everybody except the founder, Kathy Kamen Goldmark, who died a few years ago, we swore we'd retire, but like most bands, we don't know when to quit. But the lineup of Stephen King and Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Mitch Albom, Ridley Pearson, myself, Roy Blunt Jr. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. You can't ever think of us all at once. Mary Carr, the writer, will be with us this time. Roger McGuinn, who played with the Byrds, is with us at a lot of things. But the great thing is that Stephen King will be with us this time. Steve's not always there, and when he is, there's just an energy to it. Sort of insanity to it, really. Steve really has what I'd call a sort of punk ethos, and it's, man, it's just a great time. Anybody around Minneapolis, I urge you to try to get there.
Did Matt ever get any ideas for any of the Simpsons shows?
I don't know, but I've been on stage with him when he's wearing this massive Marge Simpson head and going around. And, I don't know where he gets his ideas from, but he does a great job wherever he gets them from.
Mr. Byrds, Roger McGuinn. Now, what's he like?
Oh, yeah, Mr. Byrds, gotcha. Oh, wow. Roger is just the coolest guy. I mean, I've played with him a lot of times now, but I'm telling you, one of the first times we were playing at UCLA outdoors in a crowd of like 15,000 to 20,000 people, somebody said, and I'm standing next to him on the same mic singing 8 Miles High and playing rhythm while he plays that wild solo and singing harmony with him. And I'm like, man, just shoot me now, you know. I ask him about all the old days of the Byrds and about Crosby and Graham Parsons and all that. I mean, look, this is the part of this life that's great, you know. Sitting in a room by yourself writing a book isn't very great. It's the most isolating thing you can do. Whereas being a musician is being out with the public and, you know, giving something, getting something back. It's like a infinite oxytocin loop, sort of. And so doing things like hanging out with Roger and Steve and people and just playing music and talking music and writing, that's just the greatest experience, and I feel lucky.
New York Times bestselling author, the Rock Bottom Remainders. I mean, what a cast in that band. Do you visualize, I mean, with your book, with being in that group of great authors and singers and songwriters?
That's a good question. You know what? I'm kind of a visual guy, but when you put it that way, I don't really do that. When I'm writing, I either have music going, and sometimes, believe it or not, I'm running movies within my line of sight about 18 inches away. Like when I was writing one of the books in the trilogy, I think I was watching the movie Michael Clayton with George Clooney. I bet I watched it about 150 times. I won't name the other ones, but a couple of movies I watched during this thing, or there's a great series on TV during set in the Viking time called The Last Kingdom, based on the novels of Bernard Cornwell. I'll let something like that. And it's not that I'm watching it, but it serves to distract whatever unsettled part of my mind exists while I'm writing. And I'm sort of this sounds crazy, but I'm sort of a channel when I'm writing. Mark, I don't sit down. What I say is I don't sit down until I'm like a pregnant woman when her water breaks. that story's coming no matter what. And by the time I sit down, it's like I'm taking dictation. And a good day for me is 5 or 6,000 words. And most writers hear that and go, 5 or 6,000? You know, they're trying to write 5 or 6 pages. That's just the way I do it. I don't recommend it. It's not good for your health or your family, but that's the way I produce. But to your question, I don't really visualize. I just feel it, and it comes through me, and I put it down, and I hope the person reading visualizes, but I don't.
Well, Greg, I can tell you that your book does pop. I mean, visually, you can actually see it. I mean, everything from that drone flying over the Mississippi River and everything else that has happened. I mean, you do a great job of bringing that out.
That was a good question, though, about visualization. I never thought about that because I'm a visual guy. And I edit stuff and I video and photography and draw, but I don't really visualize when I write.
So what's next for Greg Iles? I mean, you've got this book, Cemetery Road, finished. You're out on tour with that. Do you have another book in mind? Do you have any ideas for the next book?
Yeah, I have too many ideas, Mark. I'm getting to that stage where I realize I'll never live long enough to write the ideas. I'm working on 2 or 3 things. I don't want to give spoilers, but it's a lot of fun, and it's a good problem to have, deciding which is next.
Greg, if I wanted more information about Cemetery Road, your brand-new book, your past books, do you have a website?
Yeah, absolutely. www.gregiles.com. And Iles is just I-L-E-S. There's no S. It's not like the British Isles. It's just I-L-E-S.
The new book by Greg Iles, Cemetery Road. You know, a Walmart greeter one time had me at hello. Greg Iles, he had me at the very first chapter of this book. Greg, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Mark.
You've been listening to Cover, I'm Mark DeWitt, along with Greg Iles, author of his brand new book, Cemetery Road.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.